Hello, I'm Hillary McClure, Vice President of Multimedia Productions at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Dr. Charlotte Laws, an author, columnist, and public speaker. Charlotte has been described as one of the fiercest women in the world and the Erin Brockovich of revenge porn. She stars in the recent Netflix documentary, The Most Hated Man on the Internet, which covers the story of Hunter Moore and how Charlotte played an integral role in helping take down him and his website, Is Anyone Up? You can learn more about Charlotte on her website, charlottelaws.com, and follow her on Twitter at Charlotte Laws. Welcome, Charlotte. Thank you for taking the time and agreeing to come onto the show and speak with me.
Thanks for having me.
Charlotte, you have one of, if not the most incredibly fascinating biographies of anyone that I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with, I think. So I guess quickly before we get into detail about how you helped take down Hunter and isanyoneup.com, can you share a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I was raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was adopted at birth, and I tracked down my birth family, and I've had over 30 different jobs in my life. So I've been the head of a legal corporation. I've been a lecturer at the FBI's headquarters in Quantico, Virginia. I've been a private eye. I've been a stand-up comedian. I've done so many different things. I've been a cab driver. I've been a private nurse. I was a backup singer for an Elvis imitator. So I've just had lots and lots of unusual experiences in my life. And I've done a lot of charity work. I kind of started as a child fighting for civil rights. And then as I got older, I incorporated also fighting for gay rights, animal rights, and now women's rights with the revenge porn issues. So I've kind of been an activist all my life, even though I never wanted to admit it, because I always felt an activist was someone who hadn't showered for 2 months and who was running through the streets with a sign screaming at the top of their lungs. And I'd like, no, I'm an advocate. I'm not an activist. I sit at the table. I have the policy discussions, et cetera. But as I've gotten older, I realize I am an activist and I'm proud of that.
As I'd mentioned in the intro, you star in, it's a three-part Netflix docuseries. I watched it. It was very well done. It was The Most Hated Man on the Internet. And, you know, for anyone who is unaware of the story, or this is the first time that they've kind of, you know, are being introduced, you know, can you set the stage for us on how you became involved, you know, and wrapped up, intertwined with Hunter Moore and his website, isanyoneup.com. And then ultimately, I mean, we can go, I have more questions for you, so you don't have to feel like you have to, you know, tell the whole story start to finish. But I guess just start off by setting the stage for us, because I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, my daughter was 24 years old, and she had taken some photos in her room with her cell phone, and one of them was topless, and she sent them from her cell phone to her computer, to her email, to save them because her cell phone ran out of space. And she never intended to show the topless picture to anyone. She had not sent it to anyone. And then after that, she got hacked several months later. And then about a week after she was hacked, the topless picture was loaded to the most notorious revenge porn website called isanyoneup.com, along with her name, her city, and her social media link. And she found out about it when she was at her waitress job, and she was just completely freaked. I mean, she felt exploited and violated and humiliated and didn't know what to do. And she called me and told me what had happened. And that was the first time I had ever heard of revenge porn or Hunter Moore. And I immediately went on the website and saw how horrible it was. I mean, it was just a website of hatred. It really wasn't about pornography. It was about, you know, being evil, like he called his website Pure Evil. It was about, you know, humiliating and battering and bullying and, you know, trying to shame, you know, mostly women. And I knew that I had to immediately get that picture down. And I could tell by my daughter's tears that she certainly wasn't going to be, you know, able to really fight for herself, which I have since learned that that's pretty common with victims, that they really need someone else to fight for them. And so that's how I learned about it.
I'm so sorry that happened. And the documentary covers, you know, you fought endlessly from the moment she told you to ultimately helping get her picture taken down. How challenging was that process? Because it seemed pretty laborious as it was laid out. Like nobody would help you. There was some victim shaming going on. Take us through that process.
Yeah, I mean, it was totally an uphill battle. I called 9 attorneys initially, and everybody threw up their hands, said they knew nothing about it. There were no laws against revenge porn at the time. And really the only tool that I felt we had was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is basically for civil cases. But it does say that if you took, you know, if it's you own the copyright to a picture, then someone else is not allowed to post that. And you can take someone to court for $250,000 per picture. But Hunter Moore didn't care about civil suits. He didn't care about the Copyright Act. And so he just continued to post pictures, even though he did not have permission, even though there was no consent from any of these victims. And it was very difficult because victim blaming was very common in society. It was common with the law enforcement, it was common with the media, it was common with the politicians and with ordinary people. And it was before the Me Too movement. So it was very difficult because there was no sympathy for these victims. And the victims would, like my daughter, would turn the knife inward and blame themselves and feel guilty when, you know, you should have a right to take a picture of yourself. You know, you know, you should have to give permission for someone to post it. And in my daughter's case, she had been hacked. And we very quickly, she found one of her friends also posted on the site and called her friend. And her friend said that she had also been hacked. So that's when I was kind of clued in that there was a hacking scheme associated with this site, because I only know of two people on that site and they had both been hacked. So I figured I needed to investigate this because, of course, hacking is illegal. And I figured that was a way to possibly get the content removed and possibly get the website removed. So I kind of, what I did is I started my own little survey and I contacted 40 victims who were posted within the 2-week period of when my daughter was posted. I started contacting them to find out how they got on the site. And this was very difficult because I couldn't use electronics. I couldn't use social media or email. I didn't want to alert the hacker if the hacker was on their technology. So everything had to be done by phone, which means a lot of times I would look at the victim's last name and see the city they lived in. And then I'd call somebody with the same last name and say, are you related to so-and-so? Could you have her call me? So it was very roundabout and really difficult. But after contacting these people, I found out that 40% of them told me they had been hacked. So I had all this information. I went to Los Angeles Police Department who did the victim blaming, and the middle-aged female detective said to my daughter, why would you take a picture like this if you didn't want it on the internet? And then I called the FBI, and the FBI initially didn't want to take the case because they're just very busy. And they said, file a report online. And I said sarcastically, I said, oh, I see. You help Scarlett Johansson when she gets hacked, but you don't help the average person, because she had recently been hacked before that and they had taken the case. So the operator just sighed and said, just a minute, I'll transfer you to a detective. And I spoke to this other person who said there would be 3 agents coming to my house later in the month. And so I then was, you know, I was still trying to get the content down because the FBI weren't going to be at my house for 3 weeks. So I called everybody I could think of associated with Hunter Moore. I called his publicist, his attorney. I spoke to some of his advertisers. I even tried to call his mom, and I found her former workplace and talked to her colleagues from that workplace who were crowded around the phone listening to my story going, oh my God. So it was kind of interesting. And I noticed that Hunter found out about this because he posted on Twitter that someone just called my mom's former workplace. So he was alerted to it. And so I was kind of taking every single angle I could think of to try to get my daughter's content removed. At one point, the owner of Black Lotus Communications, who was his internet security company, he actually agreed to help us. And he blocked my daughter's page on the website. But Hunter, being as malicious as he was, he went around the block and created a whole new page for her. And so then I spoke to this man, Jeffrey Lyon was his name, and he said he would try to find a way to block the photo, but it would take some time and he had to talk to his tech people. So, you know, I was just kind of going at every angle I could to try to get that picture removed.
I feel like we should have you on the front lines of fighting cyber warfare against nation states, because that's some really good open source intelligence used to get all of that information and contact folks and everything. That's incredible. You probably didn't sleep much if you achieved that much in that short period of time.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I was constantly working on this. I was sleeping hardly at all. I had to put my entire life on hold because at the time I had been working on a book. I was on a local council. So I had to like not even go to meetings. I was a commentator on NBC. I like canceled all my appearances. I mean, I was literally putting all my time into trying to get this photo removed. And as I was talking to other victims, you know, I was building relationships with them. They had no one else to talk to but me. In most cases, I would say 50% of the time, I was the first person who told them they were even on the site. So I felt like a suicide hotline. I mean, they were crying, they were hyperventilating, they were freaked out, and they didn't feel they could tell their family or friends in most cases. So, so I was talking to them regularly every single day. So, yeah, it was definitely a very high stress time and really difficult.
You mentioned how your daughter was hacked and the others that you spoke with ultimately were hacked. And that was kind of the turning point, right? Was because what Hunter had been saying and his attorney had been saying is like, well, people are submitting these photos. So it's not as, you know, that kind of goes around the copyright that you were referencing. But ultimately, you proved that that wasn't the case and that they were actively seeking out this content, correct?
Right. It was the fact that there was hacking is what made it illegal. And that's the reason why when the FBI eventually came to my house, they eventually agreed to get involved in it. When they first walked in the door, they said they probably would not be able to take the case because normally they only took cases where there were large losses of money, and none of the victims really had lost a lot of money. I mean, some had actually started paying attorneys, but for the most part, no one had lost a lot of money. And they also told me that it takes over a year for them to complete an investigation. So it's a very long process. You know, so I wasn't sure. And then luckily they did take the case. They came back two more times. And I think part of the reason they took the case is the fact that I had this huge 12-inch file of data that I handed over to them, along with the names and emails and phone numbers of all these other hacked victims. And I think it like helped them to say, okay, there really is a hacking scheme and here it is, you know, going all over the country and this is a big case and so we'll take it. So luckily they did sign on to it. The final time they came to our house, I had a victims meeting. And so I had some of the victims come to my house. Other ones were available by phone. And then my husband, who's an attorney, was there along with another attorney that we had kind of met during this process. And so we had kind of this big meeting where the FBI was able to interview victims one-on-one and get information.
It's my understanding that even after you quickly, in terms of how long this could have been up, you quickly got your daughter's picture taken down. But even after that, you continued to stay on and help, you know, on this mission, and you saw it through to the end, right?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of knew like right away, I would say within 2 or 3 days, I knew that this was something I was really going to have to put a lot of time towards and that it was a cause. It wasn't just about getting my daughter's picture down. It was about helping all the other victims. It was about getting the site down and it was about getting laws passed. I knew that, you know, in the end, I was going to have to do what I could to talk to legislators and try to get anti-revenge porn laws passed, not only in my state, but in the entire country.
So take us through that. How have laws against revenge porn changed since this happened in, what was it, 2012, around that time?
Yeah, it was 2012 is when it happened. California was basically the first state to have a full anti-revenge porn law. It was very much an uphill battle. I was speaking to the legislature. I was helping Anthony Cannella, who was the state senator who had brought it forth. And there was just a lot of people who had no sympathy for the victims. You know, the public safety committee, the legislature in general did not have sympathy. And so we had to kind of bring a very watered down bill to them first. And then the next year we brought something a little stronger. today there are laws against it in 48 states, but we don't have a federal law in place. And we've tried to get something passed on three separate occasions. The most recent one is the SHIELD Act, which Jackie Speier brought forth, who she's a congresswoman from California. The barrier has been the ACLU primarily, who believes that it's free speech and that we should be able to look at nude pictures of ordinary people because that's part of speech. And they were fighting me in California as well when we were trying to get that in place. And then the other group that's recently started fighting against this are certain members of the progressive side of the Democratic Party who have the defund the police mindset and just don't want more people in prison. And they somehow feel that they need to let people out of prison rather than putting people in prison. And so they've been fighting. And then back when I was doing it in California, the legislators were in a similar type of way of thinking. There was something called realignment, which simply meant that the prisons were too full. They didn't want more laws that were going to put people in prison. And that was another reason why they were fighting against us. So we couldn't get it passed as a felony. It had to be passed as a misdemeanor because otherwise we'd be putting people in prison. So that was kind of the way of thinking in California and federally, that's been the one of the big obstacles.
You mentioned uphill battle earlier, and it sounds like certainly it just continues to be an uphill battle for the victims of revenge porn, because they are in fact victims, at least in my opinion. You mentioned prison. And so, you know, you also mentioned you are very connected, and you mentioned you've name dropped many influential folks. As far as Hunter Moore goes, you put a lot of pressure on him. And how did you go about doing that? And what did that ultimately lead to for him?
Well, I mean, just by coming out against him and telling publicly saying that he was hacking, there was a lot of backlash from him on that. And he had all these followers that he called it the family. He used Charles Manson language. So he called himself the father. They were the children. The group of them was the family. They basically were coming after me. So not only did I have the uphill battle of the victim blaming and the mindset of all these people that we had to try to get past and the hurdles that we had in that, I also had attacks from his followers. I had death threats. I had computer viruses. I was bombarded with computer viruses on a couple of different occasions. And I even had a stalker at my house. This was not even in the documentary, but there was a guy sitting outside my house on a couple of different occasions. And I believe he was probably trying to get into our network. And the second day, I actually marched up to him and said, "May I help you?" I marched into the street. My daughter was running behind going, "Mom, what are you going to do? Mom, what are you going to do?" And I said to him, "May I help you?" And it was this like 20-something-year-old kid, blonde, curly hair. He sees me. He freaks out. He zooms away. He almost hits the neighbor's wall. And so I just don't feel someone with good intentions would have done that. I think they would have said, "Oh, I'm waiting for your neighbor," or they would have said something like that, you know? So I think he was there with bad intentions. So, it became very scary because of all of this. People obviously knew where I lived. I bought locks for my gates. My daughter and I were sleeping with metal rods under our beds for protection. So, we just didn't know, because these are anonymous people who are attacking you, and you have no idea if they just got out of prison, if they have guns, if they have anger issues. You just don't know anything about these people. And that's what makes it scarier when you're getting these death threats like this. And when the hacking went public, when I told a reporter about it, Camille Dodaro, who was in the documentary, Hunter said he was going to get a gun and kill me. So he also said he was going to burn down the Village Voice if they were to print anything about him being hacking, involved in hacking. So so he made threats. He made threats against me and my daughter. His followers made threats, even worse threats, really, because theirs were more consistent and much scarier. So yeah, it turned into quite an ordeal. That's for sure.
Did any authorities see his threats? Was that just okay to, did they just let that happen? Or I don't understand how someone could be threatening things like that and so brazenly.
Yeah, it's hard to, I think because of the anonymity of the internet, I think it's very hard to know. You don't know who did it. They can hide their IP addresses. And so I think it's kind of a big chore to try to track people down. And I know at one point the prosecutor saw some of the death threats when I was in court. She actually saw, you know, I had printed out some of them, and she was said, "Why haven't you told the FBI about these?" And I guess I just didn't really want to burden them more. I was pretty grateful that they were doing what they were doing, and I knew they had a lot of other cases they could be handling, and I certainly didn't want to be coming to them with another problem. And so I didn't send really any of my death threats to any law enforcement.
You mentioned the prosecutor. Did you have to testify at the trial for Hunter Moore?
No, my daughter did end up testifying, but she was the only one who did. And I had gathered together about 25 victims to speak. See, he had already taken a plea deal. So he originally was looking at 42 years in prison, but with his plea deal, he was only looking at a short period of time. I had been told by actually Kamala Harris's office, who I'd been in touch with, that if I could get the more victims I could get together, the better, because if you have like a string of victims, one after the other, giving testimony, you're likely to end up with a higher, you know, a longer sentence for the culprit. And the reason Kamala Harris's office knew is they had worked in a prosecution of another revenge porn operator's website in San Diego, and that's what their tactic had been, and it actually had worked very well. So the FBI had asked me to get together victims, so I had about 25 or so who were willing to go into court to speak. But then, kind of close to the last minute, maybe a month before, the prosecutor called me in and said, no, I don't want you contacting any of the victims. I'm going to do it. I'll get everybody into court. You don't need to do anything. You know, please don't contact them anymore. So I didn't, you know, I went along with that. And then my daughter and I got to the courthouse and there was no one there. It was just my daughter speaking. So I don't understand why she didn't follow through with getting the victims, but that's not in the documentary either. But I think that might be why he ended up with a 2.5 year sentence. And it really wasn't even prison he went to. It was more like drug and alcohol rehab centers. It was just very lenient. I mean, for example, the one he was at in Texas, the so-called inmates could go up to the store unsupervised, get what they need, and come back. So it was kind of like a camp, you know, like a summer camp or something. So I think he thought it was a really bad experience, but compared to a regular prison, I think it probably was pretty easy.
And since he was released, I'm assuming he's left you alone, but I mean, did he ever apologize or anything of that nature?
No, he's never apologized. He has the same mindset. He's still a misogynist. He's still believes that tearing other people somehow builds him up. The hacker in court actually did apologize to my daughter, and he turned back and looked at her and said, "I'm really sorry." But Hunter had a very arrogant attitude in court and kind of a smirk. And today he is on another couple of social media sites and apparently building up his following. And there's a lot of like racist talk and anti-gay, and you know, he and his followers are making a lot of very, you know, horrible comments, and I believe they're posting nude pictures, but they're probably consensual ones, I'm sure. And because I don't think he wants to go back to jail again. But when he was asked recently what he would do differently, and all he said was, "I would have jacked it up 10 times harder because the outcome was going to be the same anyway." That's what his comment was. So I don't know what 10 times harder means. I don't know if that means causing murders. I have no idea what that means, but he has no remorse whatsoever.
I bet he doesn't even know what that means. He's just trying to sound cool. You know what I mean?
I think you're right. I think you're probably right.
I don't think he's as smart as he thinks he is.
No, because if he were smart, he would actually apologize, because we have a very forgiving country, and there is a certain segment of the population that would go, "Oh, he's sorry. You know, he's not going to do it again. He's reformed." There, people would do that. But, you know, so I'm really surprised he hasn't apologized, because it would be much better PR.
Yeah, he'd buy himself some more leeway to keep doing whatever he wants to be doing right now, for sure. As far as, you know, revenge porn isn't going away. There are still constant websites, you know, people's photos being stolen, primarily young women. For anyone who may be listening that is a silent victim of revenge porn, what would you share with them? Because obviously you're so strong. So any strength that you would want to share, and you mentioned they typically need someone to act on their behalf because it is so traumatizing, but any advice?
Well, I would say that if this has happened to you, you should always keep records, you know, keep evidence, screenshots of everything, so that you can give that to law enforcement if you need to do that at some point. You always want to have a Google alert on your name so that you will know what pops up about you. You want to build up your online presence rather than going offline. The initial reaction for a victim is to shut everything down, but that means that the nude pictures get to the top of Google faster. So you want to keep all the positive stuff on there. If you're in a relationship and say you're not a victim yet, but you're in a relationship, about to start a relationship, you might want to do a social media prenup or social media postnup, which says, you know, spells out what your partner is allowed or not allowed to do, you know, especially with regards to pictures, but it could also be other content. You can use copyright law, as I was talking about earlier, and you could be awarded as much as $250,000 per picture. If you took a picture of yourself, you own the copyright automatically. If your friend took it, you can have your friend just sign that copyright over to you if it's a picture of you, and then you own that copyright. And you can also register those photos in Washington, D.C. It's something like $35, and you can bundle like 500 pictures. I mean, you can put many, many pictures in there, and you would need to get that copyrighted if you're going to go to court. And if you need to talk to someone about it, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative has a hotline. And their website is cybercivilrights.org. So they have a lot of resources there. They have the hotline where you can speak to somebody. I believe it's 24 hours a day, so you can call them. And the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project is another organization that has attorneys all over the country, and they help victims pro bono. So if you think you need an attorney for some reason, then you can do a Google search on their name and contact them and hopefully get some help in that way.
Charlotte, I guess my last question for you, is there anything that I haven't asked you or that we didn't cover that you would want our audience to know?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. I can't think of anything.
Such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you again for being so strong and for your advocacy and your activism. I actually did want to ask you one thing, just a fun thing. I noticed that you have, your bio said that you have rescue hens as pets. Is that true? That's so cute.
Yes, I do. I'm actually an animal rights activist and advocate. And I do. I have seven hens, and three of them came from a butcher shop, actually. They were just about to be killed in the butcher shop. And the others I've gotten from animal shelters. They have hens in the shelters, believe it or not. And I just got a dog, another dog. I had two dogs. Now I have three, and this dog is like, it's a little puppy. And, but he came from a research facility. So, where they are torturing animals and, putting, you know, chemicals down their throat, bleach and all sorts of stuff. So, luckily they were able to get him out and some of his siblings. And, so he's been here a few days, and it's a challenge having a puppy, but he's such a sweetheart, and he's a beagle. They use beagle dogs because beagles are the most loving and sweet, and you can, you know, literally abuse them and they'll still lick your face. And that's the reason beagles are used in these labs by our government and by various, you know, universities and other laboratories. So that's something I'm really actually working very strongly to try to help Rand Paul's office and the other senators who have signed on, like Cory Booker, and something called the FDA Modernization Act. And I would really love for people to, and I know this is off topic, but I would really love for people to call their congresspeople or senators about signing on to this, because all it does is simply allow researchers or allow people who are developing drugs the option of not using animals in their testing. Currently, you're required to test on animals in the United States for any new drug that comes on the market. So all you're doing is saying, you know, you can use the other options, of which there are many other options. And we have all sorts of high-tech ways to test that do not require using animals. So that is something I'm actually very passionately working on as well, in addition to trying to get a federal anti-revenge porn law in place.
Well, you certainly know how to stay busy, and it's wonderful everything that you're doing. And I love that you have this new puppy and your hens. And it was just very nice speaking with you, Charlotte. So again, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. It was very nice to talk to you.
I'm Hillary McClure, Vice President of Multimedia Productions at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining us today was Dr. Charlotte Laws, an author, columnist, and public speaker. You can see Charlotte in Netflix docuseries The Most Hated Man on the Internet, as well as learn more about her on her website, charlottelaws.com, and follow her on Twitter, @CharlotteLaws. And you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.